coffee?
No, I'm fine.
Looks enormous.
Oh, it's a good friend of mine. It's just very efficient.
Oh, goodness, yes.
I managed to convince the University of Cape Town recently to buy it for the
first time. That's
beautiful. So you knew Scott?
I worked for him for 7 years, yes.
Really? Well, I'm way behind that, so I suppose you would have known that. What did
you shouldn't have. Well, I was his assistant, and after I read Trial of Love and Country and was searching around for something to do, I was in America at the time, I heard of his work at the UN for the tribes in Southwest Africa in 1950. And so I just had been given $500, so I could afford to do anything for nothing. So I offered to type for him at first, and then gradually became his secretary and his assistant, and then we set up the Africa Bureau, and I meanwhile was going back to South Africa, to Southwest Africa, because he wasn't allowed in.
Was that after he'd been
chucked out? Yes, he wasn't actually chucked out, but he came out in 1949 to get to the UN. And then in 1950, they made him a prohibited immigrant, so he couldn't go back. So that's when I went there. So I first saw Ruth, but didn't meet her, in 1951. No, it was the very beginning, January 52, when I was back in Pretoria, and I went over to Johannesburg. I'd already met Sisulu, and he and Yusuf Kutshelo invited me to a meeting where they were going to discuss the Defiance campaign plans. And there was just one other white there who, I realized in retrospect, was Ruth. But we never met then. Then when I met her in 53, I suppose, briefly, I was very suspicious of her because she was a communist, and it wasn't until I worked in the Treason Trial Defense Fund in 57 under Bishop Reeves that she became a great friend and sort of dropped my suspiciousness.
What was that committee that you first met, or was it just a meeting with Kachana?
No, it was a public meeting in the small hall of Johannesburg City Hall to discuss plans for it, and it was organized by the Indian Congress.
Was she a speaker?
No, Ruth was just there, I suppose, as a journalist. She didn't take any part at all. The speakers were all, there was Dr. Molema and Kachelia, and Dr. Naiko was the chairman, and Sisulu. And that was a meeting at which Manilal Gandhi got up and said he didn't think the Africans were capable of non-violence. So there was quite a cross debate about that.
Mm. You knew Yusuf?
I'd met him. You see, working for Michael Scott, everyone automatically trusted one. Because they just thought the world of him, and it was long before Huddleston ever did anything. So I had gone along to see Sisulu in this very decrepit little ANC office down on Commissioner Street, and he had then taken me along to meet Kachelia and Dadu in the Indian Congress office, and they told me how they were planning the violence campaign. So of course.
Well,
when I saw him in London a few years ago, when he finally, with house arrest, was lifted, he said that he'd been really very badly hit by that psychologically. But I gather he's a very successful businessman.
His
wife's terrific. Oh, wonderful. So beautiful.
Michael Scott, I've always found extraordinary, because everywhere I look, he seems to have touched in there. He's influenced people. He's
And yet he's almost forgotten for most people, so I'm hoping my book will put him a bit on there. Enormous thing on him, yeah.
A sort of biography was written about him, which I thought.
His autobiography?
No, it's written by a woman.
You mean Frieda Troop's book on the Hereros? He wrote an autobiography, A Time to Speak. Flavors published it here. Mm. But some Anne Welsh and used to lecture in economics at Wits. She's working on a biography of him.
I have a sense that he would have been good for quite a long time. Although I've never been able to substantiate it.
Well, I think he got too suspicious. Something happened to that campaign for right and justice, which he more or less initiated in Johannesburg. In fact, it wasn't the communists, I think, who undermined it. But I think it was partly Ruth Heyman's ex-husband, who now lives in Israel. But anyway, I think Michael really... Although he did make quite a big contribution to the Ruth First Trust, I think he had a great respect for her. But they didn't really, he died, he didn't really see her, I don't think, much in the, after those years, early years.
But he was the one who went to Bethel.
Yes, and the interesting thing was, I don't know who drove, I hope it was her, not him, because he was the most terrible driver.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway, Ruth, and he and Henry Nomalo, and they were taken round by Sibanda, who was, I knew him in the treason trial. He was a great man, lovely man. And the interesting thing was, though, that it was Michael in the Rond Daily Mail who scooped the whole story. Ruth, would it have been the Guardian or New Age at that time? 47. Her story came out later. And I think Michael's story in the Rond Daily Mail was one of the elements that finally undermined Smuts in the rural constituencies. Because the farmers were so outraged at this attack on them.
What did that mean for Smuts?
Because Smuts was around Standerton, no, but it was all that Transvaal area that the outrage was expressed. And then Michael went back to Bethel to confront the farmers. And the police said that they were afraid he would be lynched, so they got him out quickly.
Well, I'm sure he might have been, but he seemed to be wonderfully unaware of
hostility. Oh. Yes, there's a very touching photograph of him trying to speak to them through a microphone, and these bearded boars were sort of glaring at him. Mm. Yeah.
What was the importance of that Bethel exposure?
Well, every time there was an exposure, and it was a great scandal, and then a few months later it was all happening again, because then Henry went again as Mr. Drum, about 2 or 3 years later. And then again one heard of it cropping up in later years.
But politically, did it cause the facility it might have undermined?
Yes, well, it was that sort of, what would it be, was that the Plotterlunt or dinner? Anyway, it just turned them against the United Party, and I suppose the Rod Daily Mail might have been a factor in all that.
The feeling that the government wasn't going to support the farmers,
yes,
and their needs for labour,
yes,
which the Thomason Commission would have underlined further.
But it was, I mean, the slave conditions were simply appalling.
So Nkomola and Drum published that stuff later. The first was Randall and Randall.
Yes, and that was a totally separate visit that he made again, you see, in Drum. Yes. He's the one who introduced me to Mandela. I went to the drum office in 53, and then Henry and I walked across Johannesburg together for him to introduce me to Mandela. It was very tragic, his being killed. He really was terrific.
So uselessly sort of in the film.
Yeah.
Almost
terrible.
What was did you see that film last night on television?
I had seen it before, yes. Mm. Yes.
Considered in there rather like that.
I've forgotten the detail now. I think I've got it on cassette, yes.
Mm. When did you release
something? Well, I used to go backwards and forwards because I was working with Scott here and at the UN. And then I used to go back. And then I left him and went back in end of 56, I guess. And then worked for the Treason Trial Fund in Johannesburg until I got quite ill.
Reeves
and yes, Reeves and Alec Heppel. And Peyton was involved, and Hurley to some extent. Then Julius Lewin, I think, too. And then I came away again in 58, and after that, and that's when I wrote a book about Sir Cady Carmer, who I'd worked for. And then I went back and forth until I used to go back for a year at a time and then come back here and write, or go to the UN and Washington to lobby.
How many books are you?
There are not many. They're not there, but a lot of them are Sir Cady, then the African Patriots, which then was updated and paperbacked as The Struggle for Birthright, and the novel, which has just been republished as a classic, and the Mandela book, and then things I've been involved with, the parts of the books or editing, Hugard's notebooks, things like that.
My problem about writing about a person is how one actually casts it out. How do you decide book on Mandela, for instance, the problem of chronologically or thematically or...
Yes. It was difficult doing a book on him because of the great gaps in material, through not being able to talk to him so in a way the American title was more appropriate, The Man and the Movement. I mean, it's easier to talk about the Sir Cady book, but there his whole life took on such a pattern of his great conflicts with the British government over the years, that it took its own shape. And the important thing I always found was that one needed to have a point at which to end a chapter that had you feeling, you know, something quite dramatic had happened and you wanted to know what was going to happen next. And for Mandela, well, again, it was the material which more or less directed how it would be. I mean, with Ruth, if you were doing, I think, events and her role within the events, because you could do her as this frightfully brave journalist who went out and into the rural areas and exposed certain things. There's her work on the mine labour and her work in the rural areas, and you could do an earlier thing on Bethel. You could do the thing of her as a student trying to persuade the youth leaguers to come in to join the young Communist League and being totally turned down, and why that was.
I know very little about it, do you?
Well, it's all I know really is what is in the Struggle for a Birthright, I suppose. That Kathrada had this flat which became a terrific centre of activity. And I found that, I don't know, do you remember the chapter about that?
I do, yes.
Because there was Scott and there was Ruth and there was Mandela staying there on occasion. Yes, he doesn't remember all that much now, but when I interviewed him years ago, he gave a very vivid description, but somebody who went to see him more recently didn't get much out of him.
I interviewed him and you referred me on that part to your book.
Uh-huh, yes, I think what I put there was more interesting. And you should talk to poor Joseph, I think, who has a wonderful memory.
Where is he?
He's in London, and he was very close. He and Kathrada were schoolboys working on the passive resistance campaign. And Paul was a flower seller, came from the real working class of the Indian community. And he's a marvellous man and very thoughtful. And he's a close friend of Mandela's, and he was quite badly tortured and came away in about 1963 or 4. So his home number is 346-5850. He's working, which would get him in the evenings.
Was he part of that group?
He would have known all about it. I don't know how much. He's not spoken of as being part of it because the others were more intellectuals, but certainly he has a very nice story of how, I think I've got it in the Mandela book, of how he and Kathrada were praised by Mandela and Sisulu for all they did as schoolboys, and how impressed these Africans were at a time when they were very against joining the Indians. But I think the discussions there, I think that was, and Ruth, in fact, and Mia, I think, were in love.
They had a 4-year relationship.
Yes, I didn't know how long it lasted, but he later married his cousin, and Ruth met up with Joan. So, yeah. Who did you learn that from? That's
who? Bonnie Simon?
Barney is my dear friend.
Barney is one of the nicest people I've ever met.
How did you meet Barney?
Absolutely wonderful. I was working in Joburg, and he lived around the corner.
Oh.
He's such a nice person.
Oh, he's fabulous.
Amina, mm-hmm. Charlie, and and in fact, Miriam Petner, who I know very well.
Yes.
I see a lot of Miriam. But I get the sense that the kind of discussions that were going on at that flat were fairly important for their later political development in a way.
I imagine a lot of it was to do with immediate events, what was happening in Tobruk and what was happening in the townships fluctuating then. I mean, Mandela seemed to stay there more because it was difficult for him to get home. And there were great debates, I think, about Gandhi, and of course Mir and J.N. Singh, who at that time was very active and who since dropped out totally, had been tremendously influenced by that woman who Shula Marx has written the book about, the one that Shaw had been a friend on, who, you know, Shula wrote the book about the black girl who was so brilliant and this academic. She behaved very patronizingly to this girl, and yet this same woman had been this extraordinary political influence as a lecturer on these young Indians in the 40s.
Was this the woman who was at Natal?
Yes.
Yes.
Anyway, and Shula's little paperback, something about a doll, which has had quite a success, gives the other side of this woman. Obviously she could cope with bright young intellectuals, but felt that this girl was imposing on her too much and really behaved quite sharply with her in the end.
Isn't told me about how Mandela was arrested on a bus. He was actually charged with bringing a black man onto a bus.
Oh, really? She told me that.
While they were living at that flat. But many of those people went on to become part of the Congress movement. One gets the sense that the discussions in that flat might have helped in that process of
Yes, although it took 4 years, and it wasn't really until the May Day shootings and the support that the Indians and the communists got for that May Day strike, which so impressed Mandela, for instance, that they began. I think Sisulu changed sooner than Mandela did on that, but Mandela still had his traditional roots and the whole thing about the chiefly and the suspicion. So, and then I think the defiance campaign, certainly the day that meeting I went to in 51, in early January 52, the Indians were very suspicious of what the Africans could do. And I think the Africans were suspicious that the Indians would want to take them over.
That gives rise to another kind of level of question. You know, I'm fascinated by these, you know, communism or African nationalism, they're all sort of human belief structures. They're things that keep some people within the belief structure and other people are not of that belief structure.
Yes.
And what fascinates me so much is how somebody within, say, the belief structure, which is changing, but in the communist belief structure, And the ANC, the whole movement of the nationalist movement, which then takes over the ANC, you know, how those do not connect and how they do connect, you know, that whole process of belief structures, fascinating.
Well, also the way in which some of the people within a belief become so dogmatic and can't. I mean, the great thing I think of Ruth was that she was open to, she was very sophisticated and very brilliant and open to much wider influences than many people within the CP, but also I think she could be very, very sharp with people who opposed her, I gather, and therefore had quite a lot of conflict within her. And I think she could be quite critical of the ANC, but I don't know the detail of all that. But one of the things I always found when I went back, I would always be shocked at the divisions between the various opponents of apartheid. And because I had friends who were both communists and liberals, I was very aware of the conflict between them, absolute suspicions, and how the liberals wouldn't join in some protest demonstration between them. And I remember in Cape Town at the time of Luthuli getting the Nobel Prize, we were going to have a great big meeting at the parade, and Albie Sachs was going to speak, and that made a couple of women who were in the Progressive Party and the Black Sash very antagonistic to the whole event. I think the worst thing the communists did was in New Age and the various papers to totally put across the Soviet line in foreign affairs. It was the biggest waste of energy and the biggest antagonizer.
Who read it? I mean, did they only read it?
Well, no, I think a great many blacks read it because it was the one newspaper they really trusted and read a great deal, I think, as far as I would know.
Why did they trust it?
Well, because it was the one that absolutely fearlessly exposed all the things that were being done to them. I mean, in the Eastern Cape, where Governor Mbeki was then working for it, it was the New Age that exposed the police activities around New Brighton back in 62, when the police were pretending to be Tsotsis and were catching people and becoming agent provocateur. And you would never find, I mean, at that time the Evening Post was pretty brave, and then it later became intimidated and dropped out, but it had been awfully good. And the Daily Mail briefly, I mean, the Daily Mail's behaviour during the African mine strike was absolutely atrocious.
26.
Yes, dreadful, dreadful stuff they printed. And really it wasn't until Gander came into it that it changed.
Mm. Why did the ANC never really have a newspaper?
Money. I think to share expertise of organising. They had one for a few years and then it would fizzle out and then try again, fizzle out.
The Africanists had quite a number of
little ones.
Yeah.
Well, the ANC had, I forget over the years, but they would never last for very long. I forget what Mwele Skota's role in all that was. But the poverty was really extraordinary, and the way it ran over the years, that in spite of the Indians bringing money in at the time of the Defiance campaign, later being very good fundraisers and going round their merchants and getting them, and in the treason trial, the shopkeepers who were persuaded to give things free to the defendants, etc. But when Mandela was underground, I mean, and at the same time I was seeing Sisulu, both of them had these appalling cars. Sisulu's car went at about 13 miles an hour, and Mandela's kept breaking down the night he drove me home when he was underground. So there was very little accusation ever of corruption, but somehow they were never, I mean, also the communists seemed to me not to have been very efficient in organizing. When you hear of the early sabotage arrangements, they were sort of very amateurish.
Yet they kept the newspapers together.
Yes, that was true. So over the years, I suppose, their newspapers became regarded almost as a paper for the Congress, as well, for the Congress movement.
It's surprising that some of them didn't help to organise the newspapers for the ANC.
No, they had their own and they were wanting to propagate their policies, their politics.
What were the tensions between those two kind of political belief structures? Of belief during the 50s. They worked together, yet they were separate. Were there antagonisms?
I'm sure there were, but there were I think that even the ANC Christians on the whole greatly respected Khatani, who was the main ANC communist through those years. But I'm sure there were suspicions. I mean, I said to Luthuli once that if I lived in South Africa, I was a total non-joiner, but if I was living there full-time, what should I join? And he said the Liberals in Natal and the Congress of Democrats in Johannesburg. Yes, because it depended on who was prepared to stick their neck out and be identified with the ANC. I don't know, on the belief structures, I suppose the Communist Party had more success within the trade union movement because it gave so much training and expertise. People like Ray Simons and in Johannesburg, some of them. And also there were the trips for the very few to conferences in Russia and East Germany. Lillian Ngoyi and others who went and who were treated with such respect, and they really had a terrific time, whereas the West simply never did a thing like that. There was no way. It was very, very short-sighted.
What sort of questions would I ask about a person like Ruth? Should I? A bit of a tricky question, but what sort of questions would you ask if you were writing something about her?
Well, I mean, you're seeing Brown tomorrow. Well, I'd start off by asking about her, his experience of her as a journalist, as the editor of the Transvaal edition, and how she set about her investigations. You know, she had complete autonomy to just follow up whatever stories, how they worked as a team, and whether he, I mean, I think he's fairly doctrinaire, I imagine. I've never talked politics with him. But I think Ruth would be much more open, and Brown, of course, has worked for many years for the Soviet news agency. And within the CP, there were rivalries, and I mean, between Hilda Bernstein and Ruth, for instance.
I talked to Hilda, she mentioned not at all that there were rivalries.
I mean, it was totally in praise of Ruth.
Yes, but I do know that they were.
Yes.
From other sources.
Yes. Well, Hilda has a very strong ego. She's a woman of marvelous energy and creativity. And it's hers is an extraordinary life. I suppose. Are you going to also go into how Ruth came to write the various books she wrote, or is it going to be concentrated on her within the New Age?
The two books that seem to be, the three books, are Southwest Africa, 170 Days and Barrel of a Gun, that were very much part of her African or Southern African.
Yes.
Beyond that.
The other two books she was really ghosting.
Yes, I think so. And, you know, her later work is part of the later period.
I'm
only in to see that how her style has changed.
Yes. She was a very good writer, I think.
She was writing about 16 stories a week for New Age.
Amazing, isn't it?
Which is much higher than journalists write.
Staggering, yes.
Really small, but each one needed an investigation.
I mean, what have you thought of the film?
I'd like to get it on video because a lot of people in South Africa want to.
Yes, it's a fairly one-dimensional view of her, of course.
What do you think of it? That?
Well, yes. I mean, I think the film should have concentrated, I think, entirely on the child's viewpoint. And its weakness is where it breaks away from that, because for me, the portrait of Ruth and within the interrogations is very inadequate. And of course also she is seen very much through Sean's eyes, so one doesn't get her brilliance and her fantastic laughter and humour, sort of ironic humour. But my main thing really was that they took two very important elements straight out of 1985 and stuck it in 1963, which I found very irritating. Well, the young black guy speaking to people in Soweto, calling on them to join him Mkhonto, at a time when nobody would even have dared breathe the word ANC, and then the funeral straight out of the 1980s. But you could see how they used it for its dramatic content. Yes, absolutely. And a marvellous mispronunciation which hit me with what was it for a cinemali? The woman playing Ruth is a cinemali. I don't know why they're black, and far as Lionel and Gokani, who is a Zulu, didn't somehow latch on. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But it's really very powerful and very moving, and it's obviously going to have even more impact, I think, than the other one. And sometimes she really is very like Ruth in appearance.
Yes, this
was
certainly
shown.
Did you know Tilly?
Yes. Well, that's a total misrepresentation in the film. Tilly was quite terrifying. Well, she used to come to when the treason trial office, I wasn't well, and I used to get in around 10 in the morning. Tilly would be there on the doorstep with all the money she'd raised. But in her old age in London, I used to see her quite a lot and became very fond of her. And she was always trying to get me interested in this very hard-line Soviet journal. I think even the Morning Star, or what is that, what it's called now in London?
Mm.
Was got, anyway, even that was breaking away. And she had this one particular journal to the very end. But now, hasn't she lost her memory now?
She's lost huge chunks of it, and it's very sad. I mean, I saw her 2 years too late.
Well, I saw her 2 years before, alas. But I didn't take a tape recorder because I've always thought they ought to have been doing it themselves. I always thought there was such a story to be told of all the Jews who left Lithuania and Russia and went to South Africa and what became of them.
Tilly told me about where she was born. I found out her house she grew up in Forsberg is now a cool room in Brussels.
Still there, God.
I walked in and I was offered various things, and I said, well, I just want to take photographs.
Gosh, you haven't got them there. Oh, I'd love to have seen them.
I put them in the Ruth First Trust collection.
Oh, have you? Terrific.
But I can send you a set of the photographs.
But yeah, I'll ask Shula if I can go and look sometime. Mm-hmm. She told you about how she had to walk miles every morning to work when she was about 13.
She didn't really, no. I mean, she said she had to, but she starts getting Ruth and herself mixed up.
Really?
It's
that's rather fascinating. How does it come out then?
Well, she starts relating something which is Ruth, and it clearly is Ruth, and then she starts relating it as though it's her. And then then I get a time sequence problem, and I start questioning her about, you know, is this you? She'd say, oh, yes, it's me, and she'd start talking about her own childhood and roots are starting to merge.
Oh, gosh. How strange. That would make an amazing movie. What's the place like? She's living in a flat that her son found her?
It's a wonderful place.
Was it one servant looking after her?
It's very beautiful, and she's well cared for. The doctor comes every day to check her. She's 91, her friends rally round. Mm. There's a lot of old party people in Durban who are part of a friendship group.
Yes.
And they rally round too and take her out for weekends.
Terrific.
Miriam and Paul are very
good. It was very lonely for her in London. I mean, she was in a basement, and it was quite a thing to get around there. And, oh, God, it was so depressing and dark at the bottom of Ruth and Joe's house.
Mm.
That's something.
But her son won't see me. He won't talk to me.
Oh, he's totally unpolitical. Very rich.
Yes, oh, very rich. Tilly said to me, what's happened to Ronnie? So I said, well, he's here. And she said, look, where did he go wrong? Why did he go wrong? He really feels that he's gone very wrong.
Yes. Well, I suppose either you do or you don't for a child. Go to one extreme. Yeah. But in the film, she's portrayed very softly, and she has a breakdown at one point. I can't imagine Tilly ever had a breakdown. But anyway, I don't know.
The Ruth had the breakdown.
Yes, well, that comes through. But the relationship with the interrogator doesn't really come through.
With Victor?
Yes.
What do you know about that? That's very strange. I mean, I was talking to Hilary Cooney.
Yes, Hilary would know probably more.
And, you know, sort of off the record, really, she was was saying that that was a problem with the police relationship to a father, that ended up being a weakness in relation to a very powerful interrogator, putting her in a position, a submissive position, very psychoanalytic.
Literally speaking from her experience, yes. Well, I thought it was more a classic thing that often can happen within an interrogation of this, if this is the only person with whom you have a human relationship. And he obviously is a man of some sophistication, and he obviously, I think, was very attracted to her. And I think she became very disconcerted by finding herself relating to him as a human being. Yes, as well as far as, because she had very, very high standards. Yes, but Hilary, I wouldn't have thought of it in psychoanalytical terms. I thought of it more within the classic thing of that form of interrogation. Mm. But in the film, it's very one-sided. You don't have any sense that she might have had it. My family, well, my father was 1820 settlers, and my family have strong roots there, and then I've stayed with Fugard, and I covered all the political trials there in 65, or a number of them. So that's what the novel was about, and then I did a radio play about it and a pamphlet. I just feel it isn't written about enough, the Eastern Cape.
Well, my parents also 1820.
Are they? What is their name?
Pinnock.
Is your mother as well there?
My mother is Wilson.
Oh.
Was their mother Wilson?
Yes.
In fact, there was a Reverend Pinnock who was part of the defense fund, the Cheese and Child.
Oh, really? Aha. Aha. Let's see you. Where's the
wonderful
artist man? There's my great grandfather. Yeah. Do you want an apple cookie? So will you be seeing Govan again when you go back? I will give him my love. I mean, all I've done is send him a Christmas gift and through somebody, but I haven't talked to him at all. I don't know whether he prefers. Has he got a phone where he is?
Yes.
Oh.
No. Do I have his number?
Well, I first came across him in 57 when he was a very impressive speaker at that multiracial conference at Witz.
No,
anyway, we'll give him my love.
Yes.
And then when I was doing research for the ANC history, and I was staying in PE, I went to see him in the New Age office, and I met Raymond M. Schlaber at the same time. And then Govan was brought in one of the Eastern Cape trials. And then in 64, when he was in prison at the time of the Romania trial, before they were sentenced, we had a bit of a correspondence, and he asked me to help over his sons. And then he was brought from Robben Island in 65 to Humansdorp when Sylvia Neen was on trial. David Sobert was defending her. And we had a very funny encounter. Well, he's the basis, as I explain in the afterword to the novel, he's the basis for a character in the novel, which most people might have thought was Mandela, but it was Govan. Yes, he's got... Well, I mean, he's really quite doctrinaire, but he's got a wonderful ironic sense of humour.
He's very involved again.
Is he? Right. I wondered how he was functioning or how he... Because he's grand there.
Another thing I'm particularly interested in, about, really, is the number of Lithuanian Jews who formed the backbone of the Communist Party.
Yes.
Was so central to it. Do you have any thoughts on that connection?
No, because what fascinated me was how the Jews who came out of those areas either became communists or liberals, but then some, like Anthony Scher's now writing about, went right the other way and gave a gold medal to Milan. So, no, I just feel cross that they themselves. Dan Jacobson wrote a novel, didn't he, about some of the Jews who came out. And then Michael Harmel's wife, Ray, was kept telling me she was going to try and write an autobiography and could I help them. And I never heard any more, to my relief somewhat.
Did she never write?
I don't think so. I don't know what only they themselves could tell you about that, because I never went into it deeply at all. I mean, Joe Slovo went back to the actual village he came from at one point, found people who I think remembered his family. And some came from Russia, not just from Lithuania, didn't they?
But Lithuania seems to be
the main source.
It is extraordinary, why?
I wonder, but then Brown isn't Jewish at all, is he?
He's part of the English.
Yes. But Sonia would be, you see, his wife.
I just wonder how the ideas that they brought over might have been nice to them.
Yes, for sure.
They were confident, so they came on.
Well, Tilly said that she learnt it all when she was 13 or 14 and was educated in Johannesburg because of the terrible labour conditions that she was working under, I think. Yes. In the factory. But now Ray Simon, she went out in about 1929. So there were these various flows. And I didn't know why anyone was leaving in 1929. Why would that have been?
I can't mention. Yeah. Well, there wasn't a particularly outpouring of this.
Talking about his parents, but it's more terribly funny stories.
Yes. Funny is certainly, but I mean, what he was talking to me about was mainly
Well, I'll think of it in a minute. It's too stupid because I see him every other week. He works for ITN. A very young chap on drum who lives in London. Oh, anyway, he says he was madly in love with her. He was a young drum journalist. And Barney had a very, very special relationship with her, and she adored him, yes.
Well, he was, I think, her main support after she came out of detention.
Yes, and earlier too, when she... He told you about the earlier period, no doubt.
Well, he said that he went to a meeting when he was 16 and there was this marvellous woman speaking and he just fell in love with her.
Uh-huh.
But it seems to have had a sort of ongoing relationship with her.
Yes, very much so, and seeing her in London. And Hilary too was, yes. And Ronald Siegel had a very, very special relationship with her. And they were involved in organising that conference in Oxford on sanctions, but that was more recently. But he was supposed to be writing her biography, I thought.
Well, I talked to Ronald and he immediately said that you certainly can't write her biography.
Yes.
Which gave me the impression that he was doing it. But he doesn't seem to have time.
No, he's doing so much. Arthur Maimonides, the chap I'm thinking of, who said, oh, I said, she was so wonderful and vivid and brilliant and, yes.
People seem to have three impressions of her. It almost gives me the impression she had three personalities completely. One was this terrifying politico, catching up meetings. Another facility which didn't mix with the others is this professional who even would go against the party in order to get the facts in a straight line.
Yes. Yes.
Politics could move aside if she was being a journalist.
Yes.
And then there's this other side, it's shiny, green,
very warm. And very vulnerable. I wrote a piece about her that we used for the Ruth First Memorial Appeal thing. That she didn't suffer fools gladly. But I had this very stormy relationship, especially with Sean, I mean, who really, anyway, looking from the other side, was very, very difficult, sort of the ugly duckling in the family. And when you see the film, you realize how much was building up over the years. But I wondered what Ruth would have thought of the film. And great style, she had terrific style, because she never had many garments in her wardrobe. Ronald spoke at the memorials meeting for her about her passion for beautiful Italian shoes.
Dresses,
well, she didn't
wardrobe.
Have many, though. Really? Really? Oh, because in London she didn't have much. She had. And then she borrowed a suit from her friend Moira, who's Mark Barney's friend too, who lives in Portugal. And, looked very good in it, and she had that, she borrowed it for meetings or whatever. Yes. And their house was really quite modest. Have you seen it in Johannesburg?
Yes.
It's totally wrong in the film, where it's a nice, huge, Cape Dutch, single-story house.
A very ordinary.
Yes, bungalow sort of thing. Mm. Very strategically placed at the end of the road there, not far from the townships.
Yes. The people who live in it don't know who's it was. I knocked on the door.
They'd be horrified, presumably.
Well, no, no.
You told them, did you?
I said,
you've probably been trying to sell it ever since.
I told them that I'd like to take some photographs of it. They're absolutely terrified. They wouldn't have them yet. They didn't break me.
Aren't there any in the family album? Who's got the family album?
Well, it's not in the collection. There are almost no photographs in this collection of the ICS.
Yes.
It's probably one of the girls. I've written to Juliet too. Why would you have those different characters? From your knowledge of them, was she quite a shy? Was she thrifty?
She had a very strong sense of privacy, I think. I suppose if you were a young communist from that age, you were very much an outsider in white society. So that would make you feel quite vulnerable. And however brave or courageous, one thing not relating to her, but that has always struck me, and I think it was one of the problems that let in people like Ludi, was because the Congress of Democrats and the CP before were such small organizations, anyone who came along who seemed friendly disposed, yes, they could. I don't think that applies to Ruth, because she was such an intelligent and sophisticated person, but at the same time there was a sense of being vulnerable and being quite lonely in their social orbit. And she had a great love of literature and movies and so forth, so she was much more broadly educated in a way than a lot of her own party would have been part of her own.
There was a risk of it firmly within the party.
I think that and her sheer brilliance, I think, too. Yes, I think. Well, she certainly had a sharp tongue, you could say. I mean, that. Well, she was very passionate and has a personality. And
well, people were scared, but I've talked to people like Trudy Gold.
Didn't know her.
You were in the party.
Yes.
And they were in awe of her.
Yes.
Scared, but she was upper class party in this circle.
Yes. You know, the leadership sort of thing. Whereas Joe, they would find
accessible.
Yes, although he was the doctrinaire one, really, ultimately. No, I don't know why. I mean, I think she was brought up from such a young age to be, yes, and to have confrontations with the police from a very early age. Have you ever talked to Albertina Cecilia? Mandela used to see Ruth a certain amount. I took a very nice picture of them, which is in the glossy thing for the movie. One with Ruth laughing and holding up a glass of wine.
Did you tell them?
Yes. Where did you get it from?
Some book.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh. Nobody's told me. Winnie looking rather fat on the left-hand side.
Yes,
well, a sort of woolly hat, I think. Yes, that's a lovely one of Ruth's, the nicest there is, I think. I mean, that's her at her peak of happiness.
That is the nicest photograph I've seen.
Yes.
Except that, you know, that kind of picture she often...
Yes.
I think her in 17 days has a sting like this.
Yes. Yes. There's a nice profile one of her too that Barney used in the production of Born in the RSA. No, it was Albert, it must have been, when they called on Ruth first to be raised up at the end.
The dedication to her.
Yes.
Am I talking to Austin?
No, not at all, but I don't think you're getting very concise answers.
And it's always been a puzzle. They're this group of whites who could well enjoy the fruits of apartheid, and do. I mean, they have great parties, and yet they are at the same time sacrificing, and that's not only the communists who are doing it, but the young people. Sacrificing that by identifying and working for the people.
Yes.
Whoever they conceptualize people to be, very it's a very strange society.
But you find that all through history, that sort of either for an innate sort of sense of decency or for Christian outlook or for your political beliefs. A class thing, and I don't think that's difficult to understand.
I just wonder how they saw it, because a lot of people in the castle lived in big houses.
The Buntings had the most beautiful view in the whole world, up the side of the mountain above Clifton, looking out across the sea. Oh, God.
Lindley Warden.
I hardly knew him except in the Treason Trial. Where does he live? Is he still there?
On the tow that goes out into the sea is the last house in England, the tow of Clifton. I just wonder, have you ever talked to anybody or perhaps give me any insights as to how they might have seen their position, identifying with the working class?
Yes.
Living like the bourgeoisie.
Yes.
Upper middle class,
yes.
If anything.
Well, I get a bit annoyed when, for instance, PAC have attacked the CP in London or in exile, saying they live in great mansions. Well, in fact, I mean, the Buntings have quite a big house, but he must get quite well paid by the Soviet thing. But the Slovo's house was quite run down in Camden Town, and compared with what, say, top lawyers or liberals had, wasn't spectacular. And there are people like Rika Hodgson and others who live very modestly, and Wolfie Kurdish, who's given his life to the whole struggle and who did everything for Mandela underground and took enormous risks. So, no, I think they were aware of that, and I assume they would put quite a lot of money into helping people in the struggle, a lot of them anyway. I mean, Laurie Gander once, when he was given an award in 1965, at a big garden party in Johannesburg, made a joke about it all, of how when you were liberal, you had all the satisfaction of not voting for the government, and all the perks of living well. And when you think, I mean, some of the lawyers, like Bezos and Cheskelson, didn't have particularly large houses, and not like the Houghton ones, but still.
I suppose that question comes out of what's happening now. People are increasingly embarrassed about their lifestyle and politics not being connecting. I'm sure that was probably different in the 50s.
Well, they also, during the 50s, had this tremendous social life for which they were sometimes criticised, with parties. And there's one in Sean's film, which is slightly inaccurate, because in it everyone throws all their drinks away, really. It was only the blacks who got rid of their drinks and were drinking Coca-Cola when the police burst in. But I think what's very interesting in their whole story is how... No, because I'm always fascinated at how, for all their politics, they've never, either the CP or the ANC or Liberals or anyone, sufficiently allowed for how ruthless Afrikaner nationalists were. And they took it all much too lightly, I think, in the 50s. Their security was always desperately lacking in any real feeling of the potential cleverness or the cruelty of the police and the state. So they were continually caught out.
Do you think they had a sense that they were invulnerable?
I don't know about that. I mean, Robert Burley once, which we were talking about Brahm when he was underground and when he was captured. And Burley said how in Germany under the Nazis, the trouble was the professionals were all on the side of the Nazis, and the German opposition, the von Trotz and Moltkes and the others, were all amateurs.
That's an observation that's very much in South Africa now. It's clear that the opposition are amateurs.
But I mean, after 50 years, you shouldn't still be amateurs. I can't understand how, after being trained in the GDR and in Russia and in Angola and with the Cubans, and how people aren't more professional in their blowing up of things, how they so often miss targets, that one attack in Voortrekkerhoogte, things like that. But, and I mean, at the end of Struggle for a Birthright, I said that one of the problems was the ANC was just too decent. It was due to its missionary training through the decades early on. And I think they still, I mean, look at Tambo, and they still find it very hard to to blow people up.
But you would have thought the CP would have been slightly more professional.
I know, but also I don't think the CP have ever been given credit for their role in insisting on non-violence.
You talk about that a lot?
Hey? Well, I mean, all through the 50s, they, as much as anybody, they were always against terrorism. And they were against, I mean, it was the CP as much as anyone who kept on plugging away at these national strikes and didn't sufficiently go in for grassroots organizing, which would have been more difficult and slower, like what came up in the bus boycotts and the potato boycott when people's everyday lives were affected. I mean, these one-day strikes, they had that very successful one during the treason trial, which Lutuli called. And then the following year they had another one, which was a great failure, and so the PAC were attacking them like mad for that. But I don't quite know what the cause of that is. And then there was Legasic and the others made a great plug at all this when they were at Warwick, I think. I didn't read their stuff, but I think they were basically saying there's not enough grassroots, weren't they, organizing.
It's a good worker's position.
Yes.
Yes. But why was the CP getting involved in mass politics instead of grassroots?
I don't know. Ask Brown about that. Well, I suppose they would say they were doing grassroots insofar as within trade unions and getting better conditions.
In terms of balance of operations, I shouldn't ask you this, I should ask Brian.
Well, I don't think I know anyway. I mean, my knowledge is very superficial.
In the trade unions?
Oh, very. I think from the 20s on, they were giving that sort of training. I mean, I talked to Moses Cotoni about it, and that's why he went into the party, because of that sort of training. J.B. Marks was got banned very early on, and their role in the miners' strike. And then Michael Scott was also involved, and but it was the communists who all got arrested and put on trial afterwards. But I don't know how that thing, I suppose it, maybe they had too much faith in their statement of beliefs and the assumption that, and also the communists for a long time rather looked down on the ANC, because when they came into it all in the 30s, the ANC was pretty hopeless, the middle class. I mean, I always give Erkan and Colato a lot of the credit for the revival of the ANC in the 30s. I've done quite a bit of that in the memoirs, but they regarded the ANC as being, it's very interesting though, this is something you might look into. The CP, I think, saw the ANC as a rather maybe Christian middle class, moderate setup. And people like Krumah would be the typical black bourgeois, I suppose. And yet, at a time when the Youth League were very antagonistic to the CP and the Indians, it was Krumah who did the Doctor's Pact with Dadu and Naika. And I think that was quite an important thing to look at, but I don't know how it was treated by the CP generally.
What is the influence of the CP in rebuilding the ANC or building up the ANC? In what? That is the 40s?
No, not at all. in the 30s and 40s. They were competing in a way, I think. Until Moses Kotani started going between the two, because in the 30s the ANC were dormant, with only Plalata would have been very suspicious of communists working away, and then there was the AAC, and then you had Marx, I suppose, at some of those conferences. Well, and the CP at that time was all split up by that couple, forget their name. And when Brown's father was given the push, etc., and Eddie Rue, I don't know all the ins and outs of that, that was quite a turbulent time.
Virtually committed suicide.
Yes. It was fascinating the way the Buntings nevertheless remained loyal. Well, one sees that in other countries too sometimes. But then in the 40s, it was Plumer beginning to build up the ANC and going in for the Doctors' Pact and going down some of them. I think Sisulu, no, Tonga, I think, went too, to Durban after the race riots there. And then with the Youth League, their total rejection of the CP and of whites, well, because they were trying to do what Black Consciousness later tried to do, which was building up the African own entity and his own philosophy, and being very suspicious of white communists and very suspicious of Indians. And it took the May Day thing and then the Defiance campaign for them to accept that they should work alongside.
How did they come to that?
And also the Suppression of Communism Act, you see, which lumped them all together.
So was the Suppression of Communism Act quite a key factor in getting those two organizations together?
Yes, more than two, three. But it was a gradual thing, you see. It was the gradual experience. As Mandela put it, it was seeing what happened with the May Day strike in 1950. They were very impressed at how many people struck and that there was this organizing capacity. At first they were furious because it, like the PAC later, got in first with their anti-caste thing. The May Day thing got in ahead of what the Youth League were planning.
That was a CP?
Yes, CP and the Indians. And so they were furious, but when they saw how effective it was, and when they saw the police shooting strikers, Mandela and Tambo, going around Orlando, they began to rethink. And then when they decided to go in for the Defiance campaign, and meanwhile various CP leaders were being banned under the new banning laws, and the CP had to disband because of the Suppression of Communism. When the Suppression of Communism Act began to hit Africans as well, then they began to accept that they must identify. So that Mandela always said that the PAC, later the Africanists' line, was retrogressive because it was going right back to what the Youth League had been through in the 40s.
So that's the PAC line, they stuck with their
religion. Yes, yes. And Mandela said, we've been through all this before. And then again with Black Consciousness. But
how did the coming together of the ANC and PETA and the CP alter the ANC's political position?
Well, I think it was mainly on the foreign affairs thing.
So they picked up a kind of pro-Soviet?
Yes, they just endlessly passed resolutions every year at conferences. Yes, think so. I mean, you'd find it in New Age that, and various colonial situations, they would spend quite a lot of time debating them, and then, of course, later was Vietnam. They were way ahead of everybody else protesting about that. I mean, I remember Brahm protesting about it in 1964, saying how terrible American policy was. Well, my friends in America were saying it the following year, more or less, but anyway. But in a way, it became almost automatic within the CP, which was underground, of course, so that the only evidence of its line was in the newspaper. And then the Congress of Democrats, which was legal for all that time, was mostly made up of former CP. I mean, there were a few who weren't, Joseph, but most of them were CP, I'm sure.
So, would the CP have brought an international perspective into that?
Yes, yes. They would have been totally anti-American, just automatically anti-American imperialism. I mean, you see it in Mandela's writings. I think Ruth, for instance, wrote, I don't know whether she wrote any basic material for him, but in that sanctions conference that they had in Oxford, which Siegel more or less organized, it was in about 1963 or 4, I think, wasn't it? Well, I was in America and helped get one of the leading black civil rights people over to it, but I'd been asked to write a basis for Oliver Tambo's speech, and in the end he rejected what I'd written, he got Ruth to write it. So, I mean, they had very great confidence in her.
What was the ANC's line on workers?
I've no idea. How do you mean on workers as such?
Trade unions and
well, they Mandela, no, was a youth leaguer, was very impressed by the mine workers strike. But it was you see a lot of them in the youth league. Sisulu, I think, was very exceptional because he'd been through everything as a worker. But some of them were fought here and I think brought a more theoretical attitude to it all. I think they saw it I think more in terms possibly of colour bar and discrimination and
more political than union organisation.
Yes, because the union side of it would have been a bit separate. I mean, Mandela lived briefly in Alexandra Township, but then Sisulu helped him get a little house in Orlando. I suppose they would have seen it as part of the whole thing, but they were trying to do national campaigns, like the Defiance campaign. They were trying to do things against laws. And then, of course, they were banned so soon. And then with the treason trial, they were completely hamstrung for years, some of them. Although, within the confines of the court, they did as much organizing as they could.
I'm where that kind of question about trade unions is leading is, I'm again wondering whether the party and the ANC coming together would have brought more of a focus on trade union work into the ANC's perspective.
Well, no, because there was a specific organization, SACTU.
Not letting go.
Shame, poor woman. It's her son, apparently. Yeah.
Who should I see?
You should see Phyllis Fortman. She was head of the Defence and Aid Fund for a long time, now retired. And she's in the phone book, A-O-T-M-A-N-N, Altman. Brown could give you her number there. She lives somewhere in Hampstead. And so she was a leading SAC2 person. You see, I think the ANC would have liaised with the SAC2 people. They would be doing all the trade union work within the Congress movement. I mean, once the alliance, the Congress alliance, was formed, what, in about 1953 or 4, SAC2 would have taken on all the trade union activity anyway.
What is the CP-SAC2 relationship?
I think some of SAC2 were CP, because by then CP was underground anyway.
So it was the individuals getting it?
Yes.
To what extent was SAC2 CP to CP generated?
I should think quite a bit. Like Congress of Democrats, it was all part of the same Congress and arts being formed.
I don't remember it so completely smashed in my 1960s.
Well, I think torture. I mean, I think the whole Sabotage Act, that once Forster came in and had a free hand. And once you got that, you got people just giving away, and there was the whole thing of bribing when people were poor. You see, the Eastern Cape was always the most militant area, not often enough given credit. The CP was strong in Cape Town, where you had the Simons and Brown and the paper and some within the coloured community and a strong trades union movement. The ANC was much stronger in Port Elizabeth, in spite of Govan's activity. They had these terrific men who later went out completely. Well, Matthews was very important there, although he was obviously a very moderate fellow. And then his son, Joe, who was all things to all men, and later came a disaster. But Dr. What was his name? Oh, anyway. And Robert Marchi was a wonderful organizer, and then he went off from Nardins and the Sutus. But they were the ones who did the Defiance campaign, which became had far the most backing in the Eastern Cape. And then in Natal, the ANC was stronger with the Indian Congress, and in Johannesburg, the CP and some of the ANC. There were sort of elements of, you know, that's a very rough superficial topography, yes. But then the leaders in the Transvaal nearly all came from the Eastern Cape, the important ones.
Why were the Eastern Cape so particularly
well? Well, I think because of all the missionary education and the sophistication of the people there and the newspapers and having the vote, Fort Hare and Lovedale and Healdtown and all the others. And then in Natal, where Dubé and the others had built up their school and newspapers, they became so Zulu-oriented, I suppose. Don't know quite why the Zulus were rather backward in a way.
More tribal, perhaps, more difference with chiefs.
And an awful lot of them became servants, too. In the Transvaal, I mean, when you think of one's childhood, where were you born?
Eastern Cape.
Where? Where were you? That's where my mother's family came from. She was married in Queenstown. I've never been there. Lady Frere, she was born. And so, well, people have a longing to go and look it all over.
I love the Eastern Cape, although it's a terrible place to live in some ways. Mm. It's very exciting. Mm. Do you think the way in which the ANC organizes, in the form of sort of mass meetings and top-down type organization, would have contributed towards these, should I say, easier expansion of the 1960s?
I think, well, I have a theory which goes back to Makana and his attack on Grahamstown, and it relates to some of the present day captures of young Africans in the townships, that they've always had a way of doing things very openly. I mean, it was part of their whole battle strategy. They would come out, and they would announce they were going to attack, and they would come out in the morning, and in spite of the poem that lodged in one's mind, and Afrikaans lessons, Donker Donker Middernach, Nade Krep Die Zulu Mach, Krebs van Ader Zon Die Laar, they aren't good at doing sneaky things underground. And it was one of the young 1976 chaps, I think he was, Soweto, who every day when he'd done his underground activity, he would turn it all into a tape recorder, which he kept under his bed. I mean, he's just one case in Soweto. But I think it's quite difficult for blacks to disguise themselves, actually, because they're black. I mean, I think it's astounding Mandela functioned underground all that time, 6'3" in height and so striking, because there's nothing they can do. They can't change the colour of their skin, they can grow a beard. There's not much else you can do. And I know there's the old theory that to whites all blacks look alike, but then there are blacks in the security police who are terrifying creatures. You look in, there was a dreadful man in New Brighton who was just hand in glove with the white security police. There seemed to be no colour bar between them. They just... So I don't know, I feel I don't answer any of your questions quite directly. I go off at tangents all the time.
You don't? It's my bad questions.
No.
You see, I'm trying to capture a feeling of that period, and I wasn't there.
Mm. Well, nor was I for a lot of the time. I mean, I was only in and out. I think there was a sort of an excitement. You see, the Congress of the People. When you look at the Congress of the People platform, there were no top leaders there at all. You see Albie Sachs at the side in one picture, and I think Piet Bielefeldt's around. And so in the treason trial, most of the people charged were ordinary workers and members, which in terms of your question of why the ANC didn't sort of reach the workers, well, the treason trial had an enormous number of workers on trial. And it did relate, on the whole, very directly to the Congress of the People, although others like Mandela and Tambo and Sisulu, who were banned and couldn't go to the Congress, were charged. I just must go to the bathroom. Now, it was sort of quite exciting, the whole thing of the meetings and the opposition. And at that point, people had been shot at, you know, the young chap in the ANC, who I think was a communist in Durban, who was shot at in 1930 and killed at a meeting, and J.B. Marx, who was shot at in Potchefstroom.
There was a feeling that people might win.
Yes, yes.
There's a sense, I guess, of that
feeling. Yes. I think that it's run through a great deal, that, I must say. Could be a minute. I think there's that optimism is a strong element in Marxism, because ultimately you believe anyway that socialism will become... I mean, Bram Fischer was very optimistic and would point out, this was when he was underground, that get what proportion of the world had become socialist in the past few years, etc. And, I mean, Mandela's always, and Tambo says he's never known Mandela to be depressed. I think they know they will win ultimately, and that keeps them going, and they believe, which is a very important factor, in the righteousness of their cause.
It has almost religious proportions.
Yes, almost. They would hate to have that implied. I mean, not some of them. I mean, when one speaks to a communist about their beliefs being like a religion, and I was in Vienna at the end of the war, and the four-powered thing, we had these huge pictures of Marx and Lenin all around the streets of Vienna. You felt it was like Christian icons, but it makes them very angry if you draw that comparison, but it certainly does seem to explain some of the confidence, except they would get pie in this earth and not in the sky.
Keeps them within that belief structure.
Yes.
Keeps them going.
Yes, it's very important. I mean, it's so... You know, sometimes you envy people who've got such a strong...
I wonder if there's not a certain danger in that triumphalism. It's necessary, but also it might...
Yeah, but it doesn't matter if it is or isn't dangerous, you know, that's the way it is. And also it gives people the strength to go on whatever the setbacks and whatever the deaths. But also there was a wonderful man in Port Elizabeth, Christopher Gell. Did you ever hear of him?
Japanese Iron Man?
Yes.
I've just heard that he was extraordinary and he had a publication.
Yes. He did, what's it called, X-ray. Anyway, he was a superb essayist, and it was a terrible loss when he died, because he was quite unique as a writer and an analyst. He was very close to Governor Becky and others in New Brighton who used to come and consult him endlessly. He'd been in the Indian Civil Service. And that's when he got polio, and he was married to a South African. She's a woman I'd been to school with in Pretoria anyway. So I had a couple of marvellous encounters with him and some correspondence, and Ruth wrote a very beautiful piece about him when he died in New Age. He said, however many fall by the wayside, you know, we will win in the end, and none of us is important. And in my memoirs, I've said, you know, that's rubbish. He was unique, and how that one felt his loss, because there was nobody who wrote with quite that precision and brilliance. And he was an honorary member of the ANC. And he had a tremendous attack. He had a correspondence with Patrick Duncan. I don't know who would have that.
Probably the Duncan papers.
Maybe, because he got very angry, and he was Patrick, who saw communists under every bed. And when Pat took over contact, he was endlessly attacking the ANC and Luthuli, etc. And Christopher was. And then Robert Burley later, you see, who was a totally different form of sophistication and knowledge and experience. Burley knew everything about every nation's history through all time, and could talk with such experience and knowledge and wisdom. And Burley came to South Africa and within months had bridged every possible gulf. I mean, he went to see young